Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Silvercrest Market Commentary conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instruction will follow at that time. If anyone should need operator assistance at any time, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. This discussion contains personal opinions as of the date set forth herein about the security investment and/or economic subject discussed by Mr. Robert Teeter, Mr. Richard Huff, Mr. Christopher Long, and Mr. Christopher Brown, and Mr. Patrick Chovanec. No part of Mr. Teeter, Mr. Huff, Mr. Long, Mr. Brown, or Mr. Chovanec's compensation was, is, or will be related to any specific views discussed in this call. This discussion is intended for information purposes only and does not recommend or solicit the purchase or sales of specific securities or investment services. Listeners should not infer or assume that any securities, sectors, or markets described were or will be profitable or appropriate to meet the objectives, situations, or needs of a particular individual or a family. The implications and financial strategies should not only be made after a consultation with your attorney, tax advisor, and investment advisors. All material discussed compiled from sources believed to be reliable, but accuracy or completeness cannot be guaranteed. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Robert Teeter, Chairman of Investment Policy and Strategy Group. You may begin, sir.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining our call this afternoon. I'm Robert Teeter, and I'm joined today by a wide range of Silvercrest expertise, including Patrick Chovanec, Chris Brown, Chris Long, and our CEO, Richard Huff. I'm going to provide a brief overview in regards to our view and outlook on markets, as well as a discussion of two articles from our recent Economic and Market Insights piece. This is a publication that's available on our website. It's been distributed by hard copy and email. And if you haven't received a copy and want to receive one, please be in touch. We'd love to share it with you. We'll also allow some time for brief Q&A. And being mindful of everyone's busy schedules, we'll try to keep the total call to about 30 minutes today. So first, starting with just an overview of markets, our view is that equity markets in particular have been experiencing what we've been referring to as a second derivative dilemma, meaning that the rate of growth in earnings is slowing down yet remains positive, and the pace of increase in interest rates has been a little bit faster than perhaps markets had planned for. We think that's one of the reasons and causes, although they're never fully known, as to recent market volatility that took place in the month of October. However, when we look out ahead and try to develop a forward-looking view, we see that 2019 consensus earnings are for about 10% earnings growth. Now, that may come down a bit if the impact from trade and tariffs picks up. But even absent getting any relief from tariffs, and if the tariffs continue to be a drag, and perhaps even more so than they have been, we're still likely to see 2019 post positive, albeit slower, earnings growth. We do think rates are continuing to grind higher as well. We think it's interesting that there was a pretty strong statement from the chairman of the Fed in early October, talking about going full speed ahead with regard to interest rate increases. However, recently there was also an editorial in the Wall Street Journal by Neil Kashkari talking about maybe the Fed should ease off a bit. So perhaps we'll get some relief on that front, although again, rates remain relatively low, even though they have been headed a bit higher. So on balance, where does this leave us? Well, we think that the risk return tilts positive here, and we've been positioned at about 5% above the midpoint of our range for equity exposure across client portfolio types. Within the fixed income side, we continue to stay with shorter durations and being very selective with regard to credit risk that we take. So while there's been a lot of volatility and a lot of noise, we think the underlying fundamentals and story remains pretty much the same, although dealing with this transition from a faster rate of growth to a slower rate of growth is one that's taking time for markets to digest a bit. So that's just a brief view on our thoughts, and we're happy to address that more in the Q&A. What I'd like to do now is transition a bit to some of the topics at hand. And as I mentioned, we'd like to really take a close look at two of the articles from our recent Economic and Market Insights piece. And both of them, I think, are very timely given the backdrop of volatility that we've seen. In fact, anytime there's a bout of volatility, it's nice to sort of revisit your original mission, reasons for investing, and revisit your risk tolerance and really think about what types of behaviors might influence your thinking and manner of investing. So to do that, we're going to go through two of the articles, as I mentioned. The first relates to mission and risk, particularly within an institutional setting. Now, we talk about risk a lot at Silvercrest. We have a wide suite of proprietary risk tools, but we know that risk isn't any single number. It's really a range of outcomes. And so one of the things that was very fascinating here was to see some of the interactions across the team, particularly those that have a lot of experience in endowment and foundation investing, and thinking about how risk should be defined in an institutional context. And then later, we'll speak with Rick Huff, our CEO, who has a wide range of experience in dealing with families and portfolio managers, as well as observations perhaps from some peer organizations and seeing a wide banner of how portfolios are managed, and talk about what we call the most important metric. So first, we'll start with Chris Long. Chris Long has a depth of experience across a number of different endowment and foundation boards and a wide range of experience with managing endowment and foundation portfolios. So first, we'll just start off and talk about, Chris, what is a typical approach to managing endowment foundation portfolios with regard to risk, and what might be done a little better?
Thanks, Rob. Well, it might be good to take a step back. A decade ago, in 2008, I was managing a small cap U.S. equities hedge fund that catered to some of America's largest university endowments. And what I saw firsthand as I visited with my endowment CIO clients was that colleges with $3, $5, even $10 billion or more had really tripped themselves up very badly trying to mimic Yale University's portfolio. In June of 2008, Yale was positioned 75% in alternatives, including 20% in private equity, 25% in hedge funds, and 30% in real assets, and actually with 4% negative cash. You know, cash at the time was trash. And like Yale, some large endowment CIOs I spoke with explained they were also levered, carrying negative cash on their balance sheets. And their models had predicted that they would be able to fund future private equity capital calls from prior vintage year private equity distributions. But as 2008 hit, none of the prior year distributions came to fruition. No one wanted to sell at the market low. The IPO market had dried up, and of course, all the future commitments were being called early to take advantage of the cheap opportunities. So it really was a perfect storm, and cash was now king. However, since many endowments were carrying negative cash, they were forced to sell public equities at the market or other marketable securities at the bottom, float bonds when they were lucky enough to be able to raise cash in the debt market, or sell private equity positions into the secondary market, none of which were good options. So, yes, endowments potentially have long time horizons, in theory, in perpetuity. However, they also have short-term liquidity concerns. They're often not paid close enough attention to. They've got to fund their annual payout that covers a portion of the school's budget. They need to be able to meet capital calls, margin calls, etc. And at Silvercrest, we focus more on these liquidity issues than I've seen others focus on them. We try to better take into account the perspectives of the organization, CFO and CEO, as opposed to primarily focusing only on the investment committee and their concerns. And frequently, we've seen investment committees in some instances can be fixated on outperforming the endowment returns of their gridiron rivals.
It's a great way of putting it, Chris. I think it's a good example of how investing in theory and investing in practice sometimes differ quite substantially. So I forgot to mention that the title of the piece is called Striking a Balance Between Risk and Mission. And now I wanted to ask a question of Chris Brown. So Chris served as the CIO, the Chief Investment Officer of the Bucknell University Endowment for about 8 years. And Chris, I wanted to ask you the question, when we think about risk and mission, what is the critical number for risk for an endowment and foundation portfolio? How do we look at risk in a long-term institutional context?
Thanks, Rob. You know what? As you indicated, risk involves a range of outcomes, and it really varies from institution to institution. I was just at an investment conference down in North Carolina and was speaking with the CIO at Davidson College, and they're very specific in their investment policy statement about a 15% drawdown, which is specific for them. So in the article that Chris and I wrote with some great input from our colleague Mark Morris, we try to address risk in relation to a couple of things. Obviously, the duty of obedience to the missions of the organization, but we're also wanted to pay particular attention to the various factors that drive the income statement for the institution. You know, what are the drivers to revenue? Are you very tuition dependent, or are you very dependent on the spending that's coming from the endowment fund? And so in order to put these all together to come up with what would the impact of a drawdown be to the mission critical function of the institution, we actually came up with some what for me were counterintuitive conclusions for a small endowment that provides very little support or very small portion of the total needs of the institution. You might think, well, gee, we've got to really protect this small nest egg that we've got so that we can grow it over time. And our conclusion is no, you actually need to be very aggressive with this an investment portfolio like that. You can have a very high risk tolerance for that institution specifically because of the ability to withstand a significant drawdown without impacting the mission critical functions of the institution. So the we thought it was we have a graph in there that shows sort of the dynamics that can change based on the individual characteristics of the institution, what drives its income statement, but then also, as Rick will talk a little bit about later, about behavior of the investment committee, and as Rick mentioned, the president and the administration of an institution, to see how their attitudes are towards tolerating drawdowns and how they react to those.
Great, that's very helpful. And I think one of the themes that comes through on there, and I know Rick's going to talk about it as well in the context of individual investors and family offices and otherwise, is around behavior. And you know what levels of risk and what levels of realized risk will start to change behaviors. And I think that's an interesting and important concept. So going back to you, Chris Long, so as we start to better define and understand risk in a portfolio and tie it back to mission, how do we integrate it with the mission, and how do we memorialize it and make sure that all the pieces are working together?
Well, as you mentioned, Robin, as Chris mentioned as well, it all comes down to investor behavior. How will all the constituencies at a university, the CEO, the CFO, the investment committee, alumni, how will donors, how will everyone actually react when the proverbial blood is flowing in the streets? Only after we fully understand the risk-return appetites of all the people involved and how the portfolio returns impact the cash flow and operations of the enterprises Chris Brown alluded to, can we fashion a custom-tailored investment policy statement prepared to potentially weather any storm. This organization-specific investment policy statement then informs a customized portfolio construction process. So we do not have an approach where we simply dial up and down asset class exposures depending on the risk-return parameters that the client seeks. We believe that every investment in a portfolio interacts with and complements the others. So we take into account today's valuations, legacy positions, client preferences, capacity issues of managers, the portfolio size, and a myriad of other issues. Therefore, it's possible that two clients with a similar risk return expectation might have a very different lineup or allocation of investments. And we'd rather take this bespoke approach to portfolio construction as opposed to forcing clients into a model simply to make our jobs easier. Once this custom investment policy statement is drawn up, it's very important to revisit it frequently, at least quarterly, as people and circumstances change. It's essential to continuously ingrain into the group the consensus that has been reached. The investment policy statement is not something that can be put on the shelf and dusted off in times of turmoil. So that's how we partner with our OCIO clients here at Silvercrest.
That's great. Well, thank you. And like I said, I think very timely, if folks look back at results in October, which was a relatively normal decline as far as S&P declines go, down about 7%, and think about something that may be, two or even three magnitudes worse than that. Is that a level of decline that's tolerable and or that requires any changes in behavior and spend rates and things like that? And I think that's an important context to wrap the risk work in. So changing gears a little bit, we're now going to talk about a piece called The Most Important Metric that was written by Richard Huff, our CEO. And I think this is a really fascinating piece because, you know, we do a lot of interesting quantitative work around here, and we've always been big believers in having all the numbers at the ready and organizing all the data. But we've also been very big believers in recognizing that this is only one part of the equation for success and for long-term success in investing. And so Rick has pointed out, you know, correctly many times to me and to others around here that there's a much more important predictor of long-term success in dealing with folks in pursuit of their investment goals. So one of the things that we'll start with is maybe just the quantitative side of things. And many of you may or may not be familiar with modern portfolio theory and sort of the math that goes behind it and the concept, you know, being perhaps simple, but one that has somewhat of an Achilles heel, I think. So with that, I'll maybe turn it over to Rick with the front portion of his piece and talking a bit about some of the weaknesses in a pure quantitative approach in modern portfolio theory.
Sure. Thanks, Rob. I'm just relieved my name is Rick and not Chris after Chris Brown and Chris Long.
Yes, it would get very confusing.
thanks so much for having me on the call. So modern portfolio theory is a really interesting innovation that really started in the late 50s in the academic world and then has carried over and become highly prevalent in creating the kind of so-called efficient portfolios that Chris Brown and Chris Long were just referring to. And I think probably its ideal implementation has been in the endowment model, which was very much in many respects, a set-and-forget kind of portfolio allocation method. But it has been a wonderful mathematical engineering innovation on behalf of wealth management as well, because it really allows managers like us to take all of the data and begin to project based on past correlations of different asset classes as well as their returns, how a portfolio might perform in the future and what that might mean in terms of the overall risk of a portfolio, depending how you might define risk. That could be the standard deviation, which is the movement around the mean to the upside and then the downside. It could be permanent downside. It could be the downside through a correction or any number of other things. The problem with it is that it's really built on past data. And so to the extent that the past really isn't going to be the future, you have a real garbage in, garbage out problem that you find with a lot of engineering problems. So that the math can work differently and it can provide you a prediction of what things might look like it in terms of future returns and volatility in the future, but none of those values can really be known. So you end up massaging it based on experience and what you think the different return characteristics for different asset classes might actually be for a family. The second problem with building the modern portfolio theory models is that it also assumes that, again, the past will be the future with regards to the economy at large. And, of course, it changes all the time. So it has no way of taking into account future developments in terms of the overall structure of an economy. So those are just two aspects of where it can be very useful, but it's quite limited in terms of what it's really telling you because it's fundamentally backwards looking until it gets massaged by portfolio managers like us.
I think that's a great reminder, and you know, especially in this era of having access to lots of data and computing power, it's all too easy to fall into the trap of thinking that optimizing or quant is the sole and only answer. So if that's not the answer, then what is the most important metric towards long-term success in investing?
So I would argue that it's highly related to precisely what Chris were speaking about with regards to endowments, which is really the behavior and personality of the client. It's very difficult in the outsourced CIO context with institutions because you're dealing with multiple personalities and behaviors, whereas in the high net worth side of our business, you're often dealing with discrete individuals and the goals for their wealth, their family, their philanthropy, or any other number of needs they may have. And it's been proven time and again that there are two fundamental issues with regards to family wealth. One is that the stated risk tolerance that someone has, and let's just, for the purposes of this discussion, assume that that is the ability to withstand downside in the portfolio, a loss of a certain magnitude, people's risk is far more conservative than they think it is. It's only in the time of a drawdown, like the volatility we're seeing right now, that people really can assess and understand their true risk tolerance. And that, of course, can affect their behavior. The personality side is we're all different. We all experience risk or think about it in different ways. But it's been shown that if you look at the highest performing investments over time, some of the best examples are from mutual funds, they can have very outstanding returns. But time and again, the average investor doesn't have anywhere near the returns that are actually provided by that fund or that asset class. And the reason is that people left to their own devices are prone to buy very high after things are exciting and returns look good in the rearview mirror, and they tend to sell low, that is to say, when they are ready to throw in the towel and they find they cannot stomach the risk in that investment. And of course, we all know that buying high and selling low is precisely the wrong thing to do with any kind of investing. And so what we really need to do is work with our portfolio managers to make sure that the asset allocations, as well-crafted as they may be with the data, really fit the behavior and personality of each client so that they have the opportunity to realize the greatest gain possible given their set of circumstances or the asset allocation they have. Because if they're tempted to change it, the asset allocation never really has time to do its work. And in fact, the entire purpose behind modern portfolio theory was to prove out optimal investment allocations over time. That is to say, the math only works if you're invested over a long period of time. So even if you've got the best possible allocation looking forward, it's not going to work unless it's coordinated closely to someone's own behavior and personality.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point. Being able to stay the course is essential to the long-term success. I think one of the things that Rick touched on is how while we do have a wide range of asset allocation models here, really that tailoring and customization is quite important. And I know that Rick has a very in-depth and wide-ranging experience and exposure across a number of different types of client portfolios, organizations such as peer organizations where we compare how others are doing things, also interacting very very closely with the talented and experienced portfolio managers here at Silvercrest. And so, Rick, I was wondering if you might be able to just share some thoughts and observations on whether it's what makes a good portfolio manager or client, or how we match portfolios and managers and client situations to try to optimize for success around the characteristics that you talked about.
So there are a lot of great investment professionals, of course, and many other, a lot of with them and learning from their organizations. But as they reach for greater scale, especially at the larger trust companies or banks, broker-dealers, what you find is that there is a tendency to put clients into a very set group of investments. In fact, speaking of the endowment model, which came up earlier, there was an attempt just before the last financial crisis to really create portfolios that looked like endowments for high net worth individuals. And while that can be suitable for some people who have extraordinarily large wealth, it brings a lot of characteristics that are hard for people to maintain over a period of time. But those larger institutions like cookie cutter approaches. They love to put people in so-called optimal allocations in order to create greater scale and profitability. And time and again, what I've seen in talking to many of my peers is that it just becomes too hard for many families to maintain an investment style that way. At a lot of firms, one reason is that you have a differentiation between the investment professionals and those who are working directly with families. And one thing that I so admire about our model at Silvercrest and the portfolio managers is that they are truly investment professionals. They are not merely relationship people who are good at sales. To the contrary, they have deep investment backgrounds. They are highly engaged in the investment process with your team, Rob, and on the investment policy and strategy group. And they are working to customize things for every single client using the firm's best thinking across the board. So one of the clear attributes they have, which is often something hard to find in someone with a quantitative mind and a facility with numbers, is an ability to really get to know our clients socially, psychologically, read their behavior in different market environments, understand how to maneuver and discuss a portfolio so that our clients are comfortable with how they're invested for a long period of time. That's a real art, and it takes a tremendous amount of experience and time working with a lot of different types of clients in order to build that set. And, you know, the analogy I would use in many respects is a good coach. Our clients are very accomplished people. Many have been extraordinarily successful entrepreneurs. They're smart, but they know how hard it is to make the money that they have, and it's an incredibly difficult thing to repeat. And if you think about the fact that our portfolio managers in the role they're in, they're really like a good coach. And in many cases, the people who know us best are those who are close to us and observe us. It's not ourselves. So they can guide and kind of make us better at what we want to seek, whether it's in investing or being a member of a sports team. And I think it's that kind of experience over time that has really made the difference in terms of modifying all the data and quantitative work that we have to bring to bear on portfolios. The rubber really meets the road with our portfolio managers in that particular work.
Yeah, I think that's a great point and a great reminder. And I would just briefly add a related comment that's one of the other pieces in the publication, which talks about complexity. And I think having that investment experience that you referenced really allows the confidence to push back against complexity and to really focus on goals and mission and risk and things in ways that are clear and understandable and as you pointed out, able to withstand the test of time.
You know, one thing I've seen that's more prevalent over the past several years, we've had such a smooth recovery since the crisis. This has been a rising market with really low volatility compared to history. I think as you've pointed out in various pieces, Rob, we've had 2-10% drawdowns this year in the market. That used to be normal. That's kind of average, right? We're just not used to it. But this long period of low volatility has really led people with, I think, kind of a false sense of comfort with regards to allocations and the kind of risk that they can undertake because they haven't been tested in so long. And one thing we've seen over this period of time with the rise of technology as well is the idea that technology can make it very easy, that there is an optimal asset allocation. If you just put your money in that allocation and sit back, everything's going to be fine. But there's very little guidance in terms of why that particular allocation, how tested it is, whether or not it's been organized properly to really fit your own personality and behavior by working with someone who's extremely experienced at doing those things. And as we hit more volatility, and surely we will, at some point we'll have a bear market, at some point we'll have a recession. I think a lot of people have moved in the direction of those kind of automatic portfolios that you see at a lot of places and that are highly advertised are going to really struggle with the experience.
That's a great point. It's sort of never a bad time to review the real risk you're taking and to look at it a variety of different ways. I think the conversation today is actually reflective of something that I wanted to mention earlier and neglected to, which is that You know, it's not only about the talent and the experience of the people around the table here and the people around the firm generally, but it's really the integration of those disciplines and having the interaction and the ability to, as Chris and Chris mentioned, talk about, you know, not only institutional investing, but integrate that with some of the risk analytic work that we do and really tailor towards solutions. And I think that's really exciting, and that theme kind of comes through a lot in the publication that we put forth. So I want to thank everyone for joining us and remind you that what we'll do now is we'll turn the call over to the moderator and see if there are any questions on either these topics or anything else. We're all here, Chris, Rick, Patrick, and myself, and happy to address any questions that anyone might have. So with that, we'll turn it back over to the moderator for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. To prevent any background noise, we ask that you mute your line once your question has been stated. Again, that is star and then one to ask a question. One moment for questions, please. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star and the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. And I am showing no further questions at this time. I would now like to turn the call back to Robert Teeter for any further remarks.
Yeah, great. Thank you. We often get a number of questions submitted in advance, and we had a few of them today, but I'm just going to cover one in the interest of time. Patrick Shabanik's with us, and I wanted to ask him a question in regards to just a brief update on the economy, but also whether today's election results might have any bearing or influence on how we should think about the economy going forward.
So it's election day, and by the end of the night, there will be lots of cheers and tears. And while that may be very consequential for a whole host of things, I don't think that the outcome of this midterm election will be that consequential for our economic outlook. I should step back a bit before elaborating on that and say, what is our economic outlook? Our economic outlook is that despite the fact that there has been, again, the second correction, 10% correction of the year in the stock market, the underlying economic momentum looks fairly strong. We're always on the outlook for things like inflation, like rising interest rates, like slowing growth abroad, trade wars that could derail it, and certainly those issues are out there. But the latest numbers consistently show both the current and forward-looking data suggests that the U.S. economy is in clear and broad expansion territory, and that should continue at least into the coming year. We are, as Rob mentioned, a number of factors that were accelerating in the first part of the year are now decelerating. So we're not ramping up to 4% plus growth in the second quarter. We're kind of ramping down from it. And the growth in the fourth quarter will look probably something more in the mid 2% range. But it's important to recognize that there's a big difference between deceleration and going from positive to negative. This year we saw earnings growth that was up 30% year on year. A couple of the reasons behind that were one-off events. Big corporate tax cut, a big surge in corporate share buybacks, perhaps induced by some of the changes in tax law. Those won't be repeated next year, but what may well be repeated next year is a continued organic growth. And so we'll see that 30% year-on-year growth go down to 10% or lower. In fact, we're projecting somewhere around 5%. The consensus is somewhere around 9-10% EPS growth next year. I mean, if that happens, that's very constructive news for an investor. It may be a come down if you have your expectations set too high, but it shouldn't be a come down if you had them realistically set in the first place. So how does the midterm affect this or not affect this? I mean, the big thing is that there's always lots of drama taking place in D.C., especially in the past 2 years. But really what we look for is substantive actions that will affect the economy. Legislation in particular, like the tax law, or actions on trade. And we've always taken the approach of don't just listen to the rhetoric and the argument. Look at what is actually being prepared and what is realistically being put in place. And in that respect, you know, on trade, we're starting to see some of the trade actions start to bite. We're starting to watch them. But again, we don't want to get too far ahead and just say that every last tweet, you know, threatening that all cars from Europe, you know, will be banned from the U.S. is actually policy and will actually have an economic impact. So the most likely scenario from the midterms is that the Democrats will win one or two of the chambers of the House, chambers of Congress. Most of the polls that I've seen is that they'll win the House and the Republicans will retain the Senate. You know, maybe the Democrats win the House. But maybe the Democrats win the Senate. Let's just say the Democrats win one or two chambers, and so you have split government. The likely result of that is lots of positioning for 2020, very little legislation. Either new legislation or repeal of old legislation, including the tax bill. The Democrats would find themselves, no matter how much they like to repeal the tax bill, faced with a similar situation that the Republicans did with Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, which is they can promise it, they can go through the motions of passing an act to repeal it, but at the end of the day, it's going to get vetoed by the president, and so it's going to remain the law of the land. So the idea that Democrats taking control of Congress, either one chamber or both chambers, is going to lead to a repeal of tax law, that's just not the tax cut. That's not in the cards until at least 2020. If the Republicans retain control of both chambers, they're not going to find it any easier than they have in the past 2 years to get agreement on whether it's immigration, infrastructure, entitlement, spending reform, further tax cuts beyond what's already been made. It's not impossible for them to make progress on it. It's just that their work is cut out for them. And so we don't see any, you know, immediate thing in the pipeline that would then translate into a concrete economic impact. Just Adam being waved off, but on trade, while there is a lot of discomfort among many in Congress about the president's trade policies and concern about where they might lead, it is not a partisan issue. So there are Republicans who are comfortable with it, there are Republicans who are on board with it. There are Democrats who are just as trade skeptical as the president on a whole host of fronts. And so a change in control of Congress does not necessarily translate into, you know, Congress acting to undercut the president in terms of what he wants to do on trade. So even there, where there's some ambivalence in Congress about the path that the president's on, a change in Congress is not going to be the thing that flips the light switch to, you know, to challenge that.
Great. Thanks, Patrick. Well, just to sort of briefly transition away from politics to something on a lighter note. If you do go to our website, you can locate the economic and market insights, and I would encourage you to read everything. If you'd like something for some entertainment today, you might want to turn to page 5. There's a wonderful cartoon related to Rick's piece on the most important metric that was created by our own Dean Dewey, so I encourage you to check that out. And the publication, again, is on our website. Thank you to everyone who joined us today, and we look forward to speaking with you again next quarter.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes today's program. You may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.